Forum. I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with John Wiener, host and producer of Start Making Sense, The Nation Magazine's weekly podcast, and author with Mike Davis of Set the Night on Fire, L.A. and the 60s. His 2006 book, Conspiracy in the Streets, The Extraordinary Trial of the Chicago Seven, has just been re-released to coincide with the release of the new film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven, and you can learn more about all of John's work at johnwiener.com. That's J-O-N-W-I-E-N-E-R. J-O-N-W-I-E-N-E-R. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net. There are only a few days until what has long been called Election Day, but if you're thinking of voting by mail, I'd say do it today. I encourage you, and by the way, any of you who are concerned that if you vote by mail, you might get rejected because of your signature not being the same as whenever it was you registered to vote, at least I know in California, and I think it's true in most places, you will receive some sort of communication that says your signature doesn't match. Help us correct that. And many states even have a tracking system where my wife got the notice today, both as a text and an email, that her vote by mail, which she dropped in one of those ballot boxes, has been received, and her vote will be counted. So that helps take care of any nervousness some of you have about voting by mail. As we confront the coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you to also do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask in public, by finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation now unfolding. Now to today's guest. In the summer of 1968, I was nowhere near the Democratic Convention in Chicago. A group of us in and around Harvard at the time had matched 25 chronic schizophrenics with an average stay of 12 years in Boston State Hospital with 25 college students who would be their roommates for the summer and receive college credit for their experience. I was the program director of what we called Lombard Farm on an abandoned farm in West Barnstable, Massachusetts on Cape Cod. This was a time of experimentation in the Massachusetts Department of Mental Health, and I was free to work with staff, students, and patients well beyond any credentials I might have earned by that time. It was the summer between my junior and senior years in college. I led ongoing groups in which students were invited to deal with whatever was coming up for them in the experience. I might be up any night till 2 a.m. with a patient with whom I'd been able to build some trust. I completely lost track of time, was probably the least connected to the daily news I've ever been. I saw some of the network coverage on a black and white TV, I recall, and I knew what was going on in Chicago was serious, and that in any other summer, I might well be in the park. But I'm not sure I even watched it every night. I knew it would change things, and I'm not sure how long it took me to realize it would elect Richard Nixon. In 1978, 10 years later, I portrayed Rennie Davis for several months of the 14-month award-winning run at the Odyssey Theater of a play called The Chicago Conspiracy Trial, a play consisting wholly of transcripts from the trial. The only set was the courtroom. We were at our tables with our lawyers. Character actor George Murdoch was indelible as Judge Julius Hoffman, and the audience was basically the jury, and a few very large young men played bailiffs and added some serious muscle. I didn't originate the role, so I may have missed some days when there was stunt training, but those guys definitely threw their weight around. The play was an incendiary experience for the audience every night, and I've never had that experience in any other play. Oh, and I also taught Abby Hoffman's kids at an alternative high school, or an alternative school I co-founded in the Boston area in the early 70s. Well, John Wiener and I had a conversation a few weeks ago about his new book, written with Mike Davis, Set the Night on Fire, L.A. in the 60s, and I recommend the podcast and the book. We explored the influential role L.A. played on the political and cultural movements of the 60s, shared some of our own overlapping experiences, and talked a bit about 60s 2.0, my vision that some of the best values of the 60s are emergent in millennials and younger folks, and that there's good reason to believe that working together, we have a better chance of getting it right this time, of changing things at a deeper, more sustainable level, equal to the existential challenges that together we face. At the end of our conversation, John mentioned that his publisher was re-releasing his book on the Chicago conspiracy trial to coincide with the release of Netflix's new film. And I told him of my connection acting in the play, and we decided to get together again. We will talk about the film. We will talk about the trial. We will talk about the attitudes and practices of Mayor Daley and the Nixon administration. We'll talk about the parallels with 2020, with mass protests and brutal retaliation, a compromised Justice Department doing the president's bidding. We will talk about this moment, how different and how similar it is to the 60s. What can we learn from that period? What can we do better? And from his time on campus for years, John is an emeritus professor of history at UC Irvine. What does he see emerging among young people? And what do we as boomers have to offer, and how do we make ourselves most useful? John Wiener is host and producer, as I said, of Start Making Sense, the Nation Magazine's weekly podcast. He hosts a weekly interview show on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. He sued the FBI under the Freedom of Information Act for its files on John Lennon, and Wiener versus FBI went all the way to the Supreme Court before the FBI settled in 1997. That story is told in his book, Give Me Some Truth, The John Lennon FBI Files. Since 1984, Wiener has been a contributing editor for The Nation. His other books include How We Forgot the Cold War, This One, Conspiracy in the Streets, The Extraordinary Trial of the Chicago Seven, and as I said, his latest, Set the Night on Fire, L.A. in the 60s. Welcome, John Wiener, to Freeform, a world that just might work.
Well, thanks so much, and I'm in awe of you for actually playing Rennie Davis in a play based on the transcripts of the trial. That takes the cake.
Yeah, and it was fascinating watching the film written and directed by Aaron Sorkin, who some of you know from West Wing, some of you know from the Social Network, to see Rennie's, you know, the portrayal in that film, and then also to read, because I confess I didn't know as much about the trial as I do now when I was playing that role, but the interaction and relationship between Rennie and Hayden and so on was really interesting for me, who had, you know, embodied this person without knowing quite as much as I do now about him.
Well, may we talk about the film? Because Rennie's portrayal, Rennie in the film is a very, he's kind of a nerdy figure, yeah, who's the main thing we learn about him is that he is nervous about his girlfriend's parents learning that he is an activist, and he sort of pleads with Tom to help him avoid this terrible fate. In fact, Rennie Davis in 1968, the scene occurs during the protests at the Democratic National Convention that year, was maybe the New Left's best organizer.
Yeah.
He organized hundreds of thousands and soon would organize millions of people to protest against the war. He'd been to Vietnam, one of the first Americans to go to Vietnam. He'd brought POWs back from Vietnam. He was a major figure on the American left and not just a nerdy guy worried about his girlfriend's parents. So on this score, for one among, there's a few others, Aaron Sorkin has changed the character in kind of a puzzling ways. What's the point? I mean, you've been a theater person. What's the point in turning him into this kind of nebbishy guy when he's actually quite an important person?
You know, I must say, and this will be fun, John, because obviously I have looked at it through, you know, the lenses you're talking about, where you have both the political lens, the documentary lens, the fictional lens, etc. And it struck me the same way. Now, clearly, I was describing the film in a very briefly to my wife, And I said, you know, basically he sets up this competition, this rivalry, this, there's another word for it, but where Hoffman, Abby Hoffman, represents cultural revolution and theater and, you know, taking on the whole society. And Hayden is the pragmatist, but, and Seal is the black man. Other than that, the none of the others have much of a real character to play. You agree?
Absolutely. I mean, in some ways, Sacha Baron Cohen kind of takes over this film. He's made, it's almost like he was born to play Abby Hoffman. Abby Hoffman is like a better version of the Sacha Baron Cohen persona that we have seen in the Borat movies and his Ali G and so on. He's got more substance. He's got a serious side as well as a playful side. He's got a very clear theory of political change and political revolution. Sacha Baron Cohen is fantastic at this. They're saying maybe he'll be nominated for Best Actor. But he does sort of overshadow everybody else. And as you say, the script, the Aaron Sorkin script, and of course, Aaron Sorkin scripts are speeches where people have incredible arguments with each other and the eloquence is just overwhelming and nobody is ever at a loss for words. And this is part of the work of Aaron Sorkin. And of course, also, let us say right at the top here, this trial lasted 5.5 months. Aaron Sorkin boils it down to 2 hours and 10 minutes,
right,
which includes flashbacks to what actually happened at the Democratic National Convention demonstrations in 1968. So there's got to be a huge amount of condensation, of focusing, of limiting what you're going to cover. You're not going to do it all. It's going to be turned into an Aaron Sorkin story. It's not a documentary. Let us concede that at the top here. And for Aaron Sorkin, this kind of the central conflict, as you say, is between Abby Hoffman's idea of cultural revolution, playful revolution, outrageous stunts that capture media attention, and as he titled it in a book he wrote, Revolution for the Hell of It, but very seriously wanting to change everything about America that needs to be changed, against Tom Hayden. The portrayal of Tom Hayden's politics is off in Aaron Sorkin's view. Tom Hayden is kind of the mouthpiece of Aaron Sorkin. Elections are what count. If you can't win elections, you know, you're nothing in America. That was not Tom Hayden's view in 1968 or 1969. It is. Tom Hayden did become a Democrat and ran for the state legislature, I think, in 1975 or something like that here in California. But in 1968 and 69, it's true. It's true that he had a more, we call it. You call it pragmatic. He wanted, I think that's right. He didn't want to just ridicule the judge and delegitimize the entire process. He wanted to win a hung verdict. He wanted to use the trial to tell the truth of what actually happened, convince a couple of jurors that these charges were completely false and trumped up, and avoid going to jail. He was not advocating voting in 1968. He certainly not. I don't even think Aaron Sorkin ever thought of this. Who's there to vote for? Hubert Humphrey? The War Party? The party that sent 500,000 Americans to Vietnam? You couldn't vote for them. Anyway, the central drama of this book is between Abby Hoffman, played by the irresistible Sacha Baron Cohen, and this kind of stand-in for Aaron Sorkin's politics. And then, as you say, there's Bobby Seale, the angry black man, angry for a very good reason.
Yes.
His lawyer is not present because he's just had surgery in San Francisco, and so he has no counsel. He's been denied the right to counsel. He repeatedly demands his right to counsel, and then he switches and starts demanding his right to represent himself if his counsel, Charles Gary, can't be there. And the judge consistently refuses and says, you're sitting next to a lawyer, he'll represent you.
Yeah.
So there's that battle, and then there's a third battle, which is between basically Abby, but all of the defendants, and the judge, the outrageous, impossible, intolerant, crazy Judge Julius Hoffman, who is so much part of the prosecution, it's just unbelievable. It was unbelievable then.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable now. But that's sort of the outline of the script, and it makes a movie. I don't know what you thought of, but I sort of found it a kind of guilty pleasure. This is a very enjoyable, very entertaining, and very satisfying movie, even though it has so many things that we know are wrong with it.
That's right. No, I quite agree. I wouldn't have used the term guilty pleasure, but I thought this, there's you know, you've lived in this town long enough, and I've worked in the business. I, for those who, obviously, we said I was playing Rennie Davis in 1978. For 20 plus years, I was an actor, writer, and producer, and director. So I really found what I found myself saying, which is probably means the same thing as guilty pleasure. I said, "Boy, this is a movie."
Great.
You know, it's a movie that's got its eye on the Oscars. It's a movie that's got its eye, you know, that as we said about Sorkin, his battles are people. In most Sorkin movies, represent ideals, ideas, points of view, and he, when he does a great job of it, which I think, for instance, and I'm not saying this isn't a good job, but Social Network, I felt really, to me that was his finest hour. He got the ideas he wanted to get across through these characters, but in a way that kind of had a wonderful momentum and all of that to it. Here, I felt that movieizing it had lost me something. For instance, as you say, it isn't just that Tom's politics were boiled down, were diminished, were mainstreamed, but so was Tom. I mean, you and I knew Tom.
Yeah.
Tom was I knew him, you know, for 20 or 30 years here and there. I would always describe him as pugnacious. Mm-hmm. He was a guy who, after multiple heart attacks, still played hardball baseball into his 60s. Right? And yes. No one plays hardball baseball into their 60s. I don't even know where you find a game or a league. But he was, you know, he was an Irishman. He was tough. He was aggressive. He was, as I say, pugnacious, which is not a word I use a lot, but I think it really describes him. And Eddie Redmayne, I said to my wife, plays him like, you know, a frat guy running for student government. Mm. 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 And that's too bad. That's too bad. Now, I agree with you. Sacha Baron Cohen, as a performer, has a very similar cultural role, a very similar cultural attitude to Abbie Hoffman as a political performer.
Yep.
You know, that the crazy stuff that he did, let's say, starting with Ali G, is very much political theater. He was doing it in the realm of theater, if you will, or entertainment, whereas when Hoffman was doing political theater, he was doing it in the realm of politics. But the Venn diagram, the overlap of those two is huge, right? And he is the, in a way, the most sympathetic. That is the one that we sort of go, oh, yeah, get him. You know,
right.
As audiences, we root for him. Now, we've said what we missed and so on. Now, for the other thing we have to remember, and I'm sure you've thought about this a fair amount, is that a lot of people who are going to see this film won't know any of that. And
right.
Not only that, they will know some vague idea that there was a trial at some point. And I don't know when Sorkin first tried to get this made, but to have it come out a month, 2 months, something like that, after the mass protests of Black Lives Matter were all over this country, and Trump responded so similarly to Nixon and Barr to Mitchell and all of that, that I think there is an audience for it. And for them, they will they won't bring our baggage to it. I think to them, it will be, you know, it'll be meaningful that as the other thing that just came out on stream this week, David Burns' American Utopia says, same as it ever was.
Yeah, fascinating. You know, and one of the great pleasures for the, let us call it, ordinary viewer, naive viewer, someone who didn't live through this, is that I thought that the Sorkin ending was boffo, you know?
Yes.
It just brings you to your feet cheering. But even though we know that this whole thing is a Sorkin production and it has to be condensed and it has to be, you know, made into dramatic confrontations, still, people still want to know, did that really happen? I mean, people want to know, was Bobby Seale really chained and gagged in the courtroom? And one of the things that I've been asked a lot of is, did Tom Hayden really read the names at the end of the trial in defiance of the court? I mean, the way it's set up is Sorkin at his best, that we've seen Tom trying to play the game. The judge says to him at the end that he can make a closing statement. And Mr. Hayden, he says, you're a smart guy. You could go far in this system if you play by the rules and if you are respectful of the court and the system. Do you understand me? And we're all hoping Tom will say, you know,
yeah.
We want Tom to stand up to this. And Tom says, yes, I understand what you're telling me. And then he does the radical thing. He doesn't comply with the instructions. He reads what we've been waiting for. They've been compiling a list of all the Americans killed in Vietnam, waiting for the right moment to read it. And he reads this as the closing statement of what this is really about. And the judge goes crazy and the courtroom goes crazy and we go wild with happiness. Yeah. Unfortunately, nothing like this happened.
Well, wait, when you say nothing, it's not quite nothing. Because there was a reading of the names, wasn't
yes,
there?
Yes.
But
this
it was
is
at
what
a
happened.
Different time with a different plot twist. Go ahead.
This is, you're absolutely right. This is one of the places where Sorkin has shifted things around in time, which is, you know, not an unheard of thing in drama. But what happened was at very close to the beginning of the trial, October 69, there was a national day of protest called the Vietnam Moratorium Day, mm-hmm. October 15th, 1969. Mm-hmm. Something like a million people demonstrated in towns and cities across America. And in solidarity with the Vietnam Moratorium Day protest, Dave Dellinger, in the courtroom before the court session for that day began, started reading a list of names. By the way, it was not just Americans. He was going to read Vietnamese names too.
That's Dellinger.
But he got stopped, and they then had a big dispute with the judge about what was permissible and what wasn't permissible, and it never happened on October 15th. Now, the trial then didn't end until 4.5 months later in February. What actually happened on the last day of the trial was that the jury brought in verdicts of guilty for 5 of our 7 heroes, and they were all sentenced to 5 years in jail on the charges and more years for contempt of court. So it didn't really have a happy ending.
Yeah.
Only in Aaron Sorkin's world do we get a happy ending. But somehow it's, you know, it brings us cheering to our feet, and we're very happy that we've seen a great movie, and we tell all our friends they should go watch it.
Yeah, and now when you say there was a happy ending or a happier ending, which is that these charges were thrown out.
2 years later.
2 years
yeah,
later.
2 years later. Two years later, it was all overturned. Everything was overturned. The convictions were overturned, and the contempt citations were vacated.
Yeah. And you make a good point in your book, which, of course, I don't learn from the movie, but that there were two sets of charges. And that what we hear about the most, it seems to me, in the film, and just by the very sort of name that the trial has become known about, was the conspiracy charges. And the conspiracy charges, it struck me, were always going to be challenging. Some of these people had hardly ever met. Bobby Seale spent 4 hours in Chicago. There was no way he was in on a conspiracy. As you have pointed out and others have pointed out, there were really sort of, there was the Bobby Seale and the Black, he was head of the Black Panthers at the time. There was the cultural revolutionaries, Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman. There were the political organizers and even there, Hayden is more of, he's not just an anti-war figure. He's got an analysis, Port Huron statement, SDS, is about much more than just ending the war. And then there's people like Dave Dellinger, who is really, you know, a peace person, conscientiously objected during the Second World War, even. He's been a peace person for years. And what they did was what I was saying was conspiracy was going to be a tough thing to prove. It turns out they got no convictions on conspiracy. The convictions were on.
Convictions were on rioting. Just a little bit of legal analysis here. The conspiracy charge is the key to the whole thing. A conspiracy consists of two or more people planning together to violate the law. And if you don't have a conspiracy, each one can have a separate trial and have their own guilt or innocence determined separately. It's only if there's a conspiracy charge that you can have them all on trial together and make the same case against every one of them. So if the government had not brought conspiracy charges, and let's point out here that the previous administration, the Johnson administration, which after all was the target of the demonstrations in Chicago in 1968, they made a determination that there was no conspiracy. And in fact, their determination was there actually was no instigation of a riot either. They decided not to bring charges. So this was Nixon's idea. It was one of the first things Nixon did when he took office in mm-hmm. January of 1969, mm-hmm. just 2 months later. So they needed the conspiracy charge in order to have one big show trial. And then the rioting charge, this was definitively refuted by the official investigation of what happened that concluded that it was a police riot, that the police had attacked the demonstrators who were trying to have a peaceful protest. And that point is made very clearly and very firmly in the Sorkin movie, mm-hmm. and I think mm-hmm. we have to give him credit for that. These guys wanted a legal demonstration with permits. They were denied it, and their view was, well, we're going to protest against the war anyway.
Well, I think, let me even take that one step, put even another nuance on that. They were denied it several times.
Yes.
I think Dellinger went at one point, then Davis and Hayden went another point. Hoffman, I think, went, there were at least, I think, five different times when the city of Chicago denied their permits. What I felt they were saying, though, was it isn't up to us. People are going to show up. There's yes. going to be demonstrations. Unlike saying, we're going to do this anyway. It was like, even if we don't show up, there's going to be people there.
Yeah. And that's part of the movie, too, I think. So Sorkin, even though he's, you know, a good liberal, he does understand kind of this sort of mass political dynamic that there's times when the streets belong to the people, as we put it.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and by the way, you point out again in your preface to your book that the charge on which they were convicted, though those convictions were overturned, but the things on which they were convicted, which was this inciting to riot and so on, that was that the new rap Brown law?
After the head of SNCC, Rap Brown, and during after the assassination of Martin Luther King, there were urban uprisings across America, and H. Rap Brown, then the head of SNCC, a very inflammatory figure, went to Maryland and gave a speech, and after which the town was burned down by, black rioters. And Congress was so outraged by this, the Republicans in Congress, let us say, that they passed a new law, which we have ever since called it the Rap Brown Act, making it, for the first time in American history, a federal crime to cross a state line with the intent to riot. Now, this is a tricky thing because it does depend on your state of mind. You know, if you and I go to Arizona to register voters and one thing leads to another and we end up rioting in the streets, is that something we intended to do when we left town, you know? So it's a challenge to prove intent. There is no real proof of intent. They tried to prove it by looking at what people speech had said in their speeches, in their writings, but all their speeches and writings were, we want this to be a peaceful demonstration.
Yes.
So the intent part was always also very shaky, but the jury, as juries often do, the jury we know was divided, and one side pressed the others to, quote, compromise by voting not guilty verdicts on the conspiracy, but then voting guilty on the intent to riot part. So that's what happened, and Tom Hayden's effort to prove that these charges were false failed, and it looked like they were going to go to jail for 5 years, except for the fact that Judge Julius Hoffman had conducted the trial in such an outrageous way that no appeals court would accept it as legitimate.
Right. Let me tell people, the book is Conspiracy in the Streets, The Extraordinary Trial of the Chicago Seven. This is a book that John Wiener, today's guest, put together in, I think it came out in 2006. And it's interesting, you know, you say the trial took 5 months and the movie boils it down to 2 hours, 10 minutes. You, in producing your book, had to boil it down enormously as well. Yes. And let me just tell, and you can talk to that in a second. The film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven, came out on Netflix this October 16th. You can find it there and you can learn more about all of John's work at johnwiener.com, J-O-N-W-I-E-N-E-R. Yeah, when you set, let's go back. It's 2005, 2004. When you decided to produce this book, because most of it does consist of transcripts.
Yes.
What was your thinking? What were the challenges? What, you know, a little bit about that process.
Well, at that point, there was going to be another movie. There have been 3 or 4 movies about the trial. All of them had been based on the actual transcripts because they are so unbelievably dramatic.
The play that I was in.
Like the play that you did. Like people said, this has got to be, you know, a play. This has got to be a movie. So there have been 3 or 4 movies over the last couple of decades. And a movie, and the Sorkin one started out, I think, you know, in 2009 or something like that was the original, when they originally got the idea of doing this. And, you know, in Hollywood, you know, it takes a while. Things fall apart. They come back together. The writers go on strike. The actors go off and do something else. Anyway, this was put together at a time when another movie was supposed to be coming out, which then got delayed for years and so on. There have also been a couple of different published versions of abridgments of the trial transcript. The actual trial transcript is tens of thousands of pages long. No one would ever read this.
Right. Except people trying to condense it into something smaller.
Trying to excerpt it. Yes.
Like
so
you.
our goal was to boil it down to about 200 the 200 best pages, and you know, these are pretty darn good pages. I think we did a good job of that. But the most important thing here is that I wrote a 40-page introduction, kind of explaining the whole thing. Who are the characters? What are the legal issues? What's the political situation? What actually happened? How do you understand the prosecution? How do you understand the verdicts? What's happened to everybody ever since? That was, I think, the real contribution. In addition, we were lucky enough to get drawings by Jules Feiffer, the world-famous Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist who spent the whole 4 months in the courtroom drawing everything. No cameras were allowed in the courtrooms. And then we have a cover photograph by Richard Avedon. The original is now in the Museum of Modern Art. It's really it's shot the very first day of the trial of all the defendants lined up. And you can see in this picture, Tom Hayden does not have a haircut like Eddie Redmayne had in character. Tom Hayden has a big mop head of hair. He looks like a beetle or something like that. So we have the abridged transcript, 200 best pages. We have the 40-page introduction. We have the drawings, we have the photograph, and that made a book. And then when the new movie came out, we said, hey, you know what? We should redo this because people, you know, will might be interested in reading about what actually happened and finding out what the real history is. So now we put a starburst on the cover that says now a major motion picture.
That must have been fun. As an author, one never minds when there's a major motion picture to boost sales. One little thing, by the way, that you and I had mentioned off air was that when the book came out in 2006, you called it The Trial of the Chicago 8.
Yes. This is a burning, has been a burning issue ever since 1969. It started out with 8 because Bobby Seale was part of the indicted conspirators. After he was gagged and chained in the courtroom, his case was severed, and in the end, there were 7. So do you call it the 8 or the 7? Well, for a long time, a lot of us said the correct position is 8. To call it 7 means you're leaving out Bobby Seale, and that, of course, is racist. Don't do it.
Yeah, he may not have been a conspirator, but he was a victim of this thing.
Yes. So we called it the 8 in the but. And we're never, I don't really understand, I've never read exactly why Aaron Sorkin wanted to call it the 7. Obviously, he's referring to the verdicts, the people at the end. He shows all 8 of them, you know, one of the top billed person, maybe it's just an alphabetical order, is Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, who plays Bobby Seale. So Bobby Seale gets a lot of attention, kind of the dramatic
center
of the
film. Of the defendants, he's the third most prominent.
And has the most dramatic single scene.
Yes, yes.
So they certainly know how important Bobby Seale was, and that's very important to the film. But he calls it the 7. You know, Hollywood has 1,000 times more power than the average book author. So we decided we better use their term to for our book, so people will know it's the same trial.
Right. So the reissue has gone from 8 to 7. You know, one of the things that went through my mind was that although it was not a hit, it was quite a wonderful movie, and I think the first one that many of us saw by John Sayles of the the trial of the Secaucus 7.
Oh, yeah, that was a wonderful movie.
But I think, you know, when something like that happens, it begins to reinforce in the public consciousness the sevenness of it, you know? And it just, it's somehow, because I don't think Aaron Sorkin's the first. I must say, have always referred to it as the Chicago 8. And my guess is you have as well. But the convention to call it the Chicago 7 has been around for a long time, and Lord knows exactly how that happened. But it does change in some ways the meaning of it. Let me see what we're I found a quote that you had from Hoffman that I'm going to move now to the parallel sort of with the present. Okay.
Okay.
And you have a quote from Judge Julius Hoffman, who at one point says, if there's any judge who looks after underprivileged members of other races, it's me.
Yes.
Which sounds just like Donald Trump saying, no one's ever done more for the black person in America than I.
Excellent. Excellent point. I think you're the first person to find this parallel. Congratulations and thank you.
I mean, it's just, it's both shocking and same as it ever was. One other thing that you point out that I'm just going to mention is that the long-suffering jury who made this, quote, compromise, which ended up, you know, with these at least temporary convictions, these 5 convictions, the jury was sequestered and the defendants were not.
Yeah. The jurors had to stay in a hotel for 4.5 months, cut off from their families and from all news of the outside world, which God forbid might contain something about the trial. So they really suffered. I feel bad for this jury. even though they brought in the guilty verdicts, they suffered more than anybody else in this trial.
But I'm saying the choice of not compromising for those four who went along with the guilty verdicts was, you know, sitting in that room for another day or two or three or four. And there was, you know, there was increased motivation. But the defendants, as we see in the movie, the defendants are free at night to go out and make speeches and public appearances, and we watch them do so.
Yeah, and raise money and recruit new witnesses. You'd think that the prosecution would be unhappy about that, but they knew that sequestering the jury was going to work for them.
Yes, exactly. To not allow them to be exposed to the way the public might actually feel about some of this. You also quote, and this is a, you know, this isn't that you dug up this quote, but Mayor Daley says, shoot to kill. Now, this was before Kent State, yeah. And as far as we know, no one was killed. But that reminded me of somewhat close to the rhetoric of Trump, and it reminded me of the execution of Michael Forrest, I'm not sure quite how to pronounce his last name, Renoel, the fellow who was alleged to be the shooter of a right-wing protester in a protest and then was gunned down by law enforcement, which basically, yeah. as what we can learn from witnesses, was basically a judge, the law enforcement officers who did this, judge, jury, executioner.
We should mention in this context, Fred Hampton, the head of the Black
yes.
Panthers in Chicago, young, charismatic guy who's portrayed in the film, was murdered in his bed by the Chicago police during the trial, which was one of the lowest point of the trial.
And up until then, we see him as
in the streets of somebody who was
in
his bed.
And we also see him as a confidant of Bobby Seale.
Yes.
And it is Seale's, if you will, sort of biggest breakdown, break out, which leads to his being bound and gagged and separated, and his trial separated, is after the murder of Hampton. And I don't know whether that's correct with the actual chronology or that was just the film's chronology.
No, I think it is.
Yeah.
I think that part is correct.
Yeah. And I had forgotten that it happened during the trial.
It's easy to forget.
Yeah. You also point out that Davis and Hayden had written a very clear position paper about the nonviolence, which because, and this fits the difference in their, in they saw a nonviolent demonstration in Chicago as a recruitment tool for more participation against the war, and a violent confrontation as a scaring and alienating folks so that they would stay away from the anti-war movement. This was not allowed in the trial, right?
Correct. And in fact, that did have a huge effect on the size of the protest. I can remember this from the time, they were anticipating 100,000 people might come to this demonstration. There had been huge anti-war demonstrations. But once it became clear that the demonstrations were not going to get permits and that Mayor Daley was ordering shoot to kill, most people decided not to go. So the people who did show up were the young men who, you know, were ready to fight the police and who were willing to fight the police once they were attacked. But if it hadn't been for that, if it had been a legal, peaceful demonstration, there certainly would have been at least 100,000 people and maybe more.
Right.
It ended up being one of the smallest anti-war
national
mobilizations. I mean, while this was going on, the November 15th Vietnam Moratorium Day at the Washington Monument had something like 500,000 people showed up for that. So the hundreds of thousands were ready, and the fact that only 10,000 ended up going to Chicago. I mean, in the end, it didn't really matter that it was 10,000 and not 100,000. They still made history, but right. It could have been very different.
Right. And I'm reminded of, I've had her on the show in the last couple of years, the work of Erika Chenoweth. Are you familiar with this or not?
No, tell me about it.
Okay, so she's, I think she's at the Kennedy School now, but she and another author whose name is slipping my mind right now did the research. And the question they ask is it more successful to demonstrate violently or nonviolently? And it is clear from their research, and they're looking at actually toppling of regimes, not just, some small local issue, that nonviolent is markedly more successful for exactly the reasons that Davis and Hayden were putting forward nonviolence.
You're talking here about South Africa, yeah. about Gorbachev in Russia. There are many vivid examples of how nonviolent protests led to the end of oppressive regimes.
And the reason is that people who sympathize will join a nonviolent protest. And their statistic in that book is 3.5%. If you ever get 3.5% willing to demonstrate, you basically win. Now, in America, that's with 340 million, that's, 12 million or something, and I think the Black Lives Matter was the largest at like two, or the women's marches and the Black Lives Matters have both been in the 2 to 3 million range, but it's worth kind of knowing that number looks out there, and you may hear that people. I saw someone say it on TV recently. All you got to convince is 3.5%. Well, it isn't just you got to convince them. You got to actually get them out in the street, but just something for people to look at as we look into the months ahead. Because, as you point out, the Johnson administration, for all its lies and aggression in Vietnam, was not going to treat this demonstration or any demonstration the way Nixon did, and the way that Trump would like to.
Well, let me interrupt here to say this is a striking thing that no government since the fiasco of the Chicago conspiracy trial has brought conspiracy charges against the leaders of a national demonstration, including Trump. Trump has tweeted about it.
Mm-hmm.
He's threatened to do it. He's threatened various other similar things. But in fact, this was the first and last time that the leaders of a national protest movement were ever put on trial and, on charges that could put them in jail for years. So, I mean, it was a tremendous innovation of Nixon's, and I think we have to say one that didn't succeed.
Right. Well, that I mean, as you point out, I hope people didn't miss it, was that one of the reasons why the conspiracy charge was crucial was that Abbie Hoffman was not the only one thinking about political theater. Nixon and Mitchell were as well, and to get all of them on trial in one place, and especially in Daley's backyard, was something they very much wanted, and they needed the conspiracy charge to do that. But it also raises the bar enormously high for success. Last time around, we talked a bit about what I said. Instead of keeping me awake at night, it sort of makes me kind of hopeful at night, which is this notion that I said of 60s 2.0, of the millennials and the Generation Z and now high school kids sharing a lot of the best values of the 60s. And yet, as you and I both agreed when we talked a month ago, with advantages, I feel, and I'll just very quickly say what my three were. One, that technology allows people to organize very, very quickly, allows people to not feel isolated, allows people to be nimble. And then the talent pool is so much bigger. As I use as an example, that the Chicago 8 was 7 white males and 1 black male, no women. Nowadays, the originators, the leaders of Black Lives Matter are women. We have a pool that now includes women. It includes immigrants. It includes people of all different ethnicities. It includes the disabled. It includes LGBTQ. The talent pool for leading change is so much more. And then back then, that generation was to a great extent on their own. And that now I feel that there's, as I said, high school, Z, X, millennials, and boomers. There's many, many people, and it was proven true in the Black Lives Matter protests. I did find a wonderful quote. Abby Hoffman committed suicide in 89, so 20 years after the trial. And shortly, I believe, before he died, he wrote about the 60s, and he said, "We were young, reckless, arrogant, silly, headstrong, and right."
Great.
And he said, "I regret nothing." And then he lists, you know, we stopped a war, we got a president to resign, we, you know, civil rights, women's rights, etc. And I was really struck when I saw that he's with his own sort of bipolar thing, he himself wasn't willing to live on, but he made his statement about the 60s. So just some of your thoughts about, we're at this moment where there's going to be an election in a few weeks. And it looks more and more like it's not going to go Trump's way. It's going to go America's way. And what happens then? And where we all are, and what this, the stuff that we were talking about throughout the rest of this hour, you know, what they tell us about where we are.
Well, it's a whole world better, partly for the reasons that you have just laid out so eloquently. We've had the summer of demonstrations of Black Lives Matter were the biggest demonstrations in American history, and they were everywhere. It wasn't just at college campuses and, you know, in the streets of the big cities. Small towns everywhere in America had Black Lives Matter demonstrations. These were very multicultural, multi-age, as you've pointed out. Really an awesome movement has taken the streets over the summer.
And during a pandemic.
And during a pandemic. Second of all, whatever you might think about Trump, the political situation that we face this week, this month, is much better than the one we faced in 1968. In 1968, remember, Bobby Kennedy, the liberal hope, had been assassinated. Eugene McCarthy, the other anti-war candidate, had failed. We were stuck with either the Democratic Party, which had made the war in Vietnam and escalated it to the point where there were 500,000 troops there, or Richard Nixon, you know, who had been part of McCarthyism and been on HUAC and, you know, was the worst kind of Republican. That was the choice we face. You know, we have a much better choice now. Nobody is arguing. Well, there may be a few of our friends arguing that you shouldn't vote for Biden. But, you know, 99% of all our friends, even they know that Biden has a lot of limitations, a lot of weaknesses. His past is not very inspiring. But we really, this is, elections are about choosing. And we're going to choose Biden. And there isn't a big debate about this anymore. Whereas in 1968, there really wasn't anybody to vote for anymore. And so our situation is much better in that we have a political path out. But then, as you say, what happens on January 21st? Biden takes the oath of office on January 20th. Then it's, we really have to go to work. Then it is up to us to go back to the streets and to press Biden to do the right thing, because I'm not very confident that he knows the right thing at this point. And he's going to need some people helping him along with loud voices and firm convictions and clear ideas.
With that in mind, I'm always reminded first of what I saw and said when Clinton was elected in 92, which was go back to Franklin Roosevelt. He's elected at a time of crisis. He is basically a wealthy New York moderate, and he gets demands from the farmers, he gets demands from the unions, he gets demands, and he says, make me do it.
Exactly. Yes.
And that's what we need. Now, I, by the way, I was also thinking of that you know, November 4th, which is when the militias who were plotting to kidnap and maybe execute Gretchen Whitmer feel this is their moment. They have been standing by long enough. And Trump will still be president, and Barr will still be attorney general. That period between the election and the inauguration is the one that has me the most concerned.
Yes, me too. I was very heartened by Trump's seemingly offhand remark on Friday in Macon, Georgia, where he said, if I lose this election, maybe I'll have to leave the country. Now, it is very interesting that that is what he's thinking about now, as opposed to maybe if I lose the election, I'll have to lead a military coup and end American democracy. No, he's thinking maybe he'll leave the country. You know, he certainly is a flight risk for the district attorney of New York and a few other places. But I think it's encouraging that that's what's on Trump's mind right now. Maybe he'll just leave.
Yeah, that was I must agree with you. That was wow. Because the other impulse has been so consistent. Okay, we've got to bring this to a close. Such a pleasure, John. So again, the book is Conspiracy in the Streets, The Extraordinary Trial of the Chicago Seven. The film available on Netflix is The Trial of the Chicago Seven. You can learn more about all of John's work, his podcast for The Nation magazine, his show on KPFK, his other writings at johnweiner.com. That's J-O-N-W-I-E-N-E-R, johnweiner.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or worldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website, terrencemcnally.net. And the other is A World That Just Might Work, all one word. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement where I tell you guests and issues, and usually it's 8 to 10 articles that sort of flesh out the conversation, articles that I find relevant and timely. The one that I sent out this past weekend was all about what you can do to help in the election. If anyone wants me to send you that, it's registration, texting, phoning, who to donate to if you want to get your money into the grassroots instead of into the rich consultants' pockets, all of that, email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, and I will send it to you. You can also sign up there to get my weekly announcement. You can subscribe and listen to the Freeform Podcast on Apple Podcasts and most of the other podcast sites. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to G in production and George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, John Wiener. Keep up the good work.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.